questions? So the hope today is to go on to biology. We've covered all the other bases. That's chapter 28 in the book. Kind of the last chance to get some points before the final is to do the post-test. You might remember way back in August, you took this kind of 20-question multiple choice test that showed you, told me what you already knew, and now hopefully you know more. Although some of those questions will still seem foreign to you because we haven't talked about some of the material that's on that test. That's a nationally scaled test, so kind of no surprise. So it's not currently there isn't a link to that on the webpage, but I'll put up a link today. And you just need to take that sometime before you take the final. So before it wasn't in any sense graded, that is to say everyone got the same grade, which was 100%, and now your score will actually count into your total of, I don't know, 700 odd points for homework, quiz, grade, all that sort of stuff. I don't know if this is the best time to schedule, but we should be giving it some thought. Time for a review session, presumably on the study day. And another topic that's usually a perennial is people who have conflicts with the scheduled exam time. So right now I couldn't tell you what the scheduled exam time is. It's online. But you should check it out to see whether it's going to work for you. And I'm usually happy to schedule an alternative time. So at the same time we study the help session, if you have a conflict, maybe you should come up with an alternative time that would work for you, and we can vote out some other time you can take the exam too. So earlier we were talking to people, the structure of the final is the same as the structure of the other exams, except it's proportionately longer. So it'll have true-false section and a short answer question and a longer answer question. And I'll recycle lots of questions from the exam. There'll be topics that'll be since the last exam, and chief among those is going to be stuff about the sun. But if you look at the old exam 3 from 2011 or from exam 2 in 2012, you can see the sorts of questions that are appropriate for the sun. I hope to get back your lab report. They always take longer to grade than I think. And then you'll have a really good idea of what your, should have a really good idea of what your grade is in the course. Because aside then from this post-test and the final, all of the points will be in, and I'll write on that exam what your current grade is, but you might also want to drop me some email to ask me questions like, what do I need to get on the final in order to get grade X? I'm quite happy to answer those sorts of questions. Best way to do it is with email, because then I can kind of sit back at my leisure and look at the spreadsheet as opposed to trying to, on the fly, find all that stuff. Okay, so we start out talking about the sunspot cycle. So we talked about sunspots a while ago. Sunspots are magnetically restricted regions on the surface of the sun, and because they're not taking part in the convection, they can cool off, and because they're slightly cooler than the rest of the photosphere, they look black, but they're really quite bright. And we have this sequence. It was discovered that the number of sunspots isn't anything like a constant. It has a approximately 11-year cycle, and they come and go, and we've been in a sunspot minimum, and we're about to enter a sunspot maximum. And sunspots are just kind of the tip of the iceberg. That is to say, all the magnetic phenomena are going to become more prominent in the next few months and weeks as we approach another sunspot maximum. And what we said is that this is related to the global magnetic field of the sun. And what happens is if at this time the north pole of the sun was a magnetic north pole, then at this time the north pole of the sun was a magnetic south pole, and at this point the north pole of the sun was again a magnetic north pole. So it's actually a 22-year cycle to get back to the same magnetic field configuration, but of course the sunspots don't care whether it's a north or a south pole. It's just a matter of the strength of the magnetic field. So oddly enough, there's some evidence that maybe the sunspots our sun hasn't been continually cycling through the sunspots. The data so as long as there have been really good observations, there have been sunspots, but 300 years ago, people were making kind of spotty observations of sunspots, and when we go back and analyze that data, it looks like there weren't nearly as many sunspots as there are currently. So there's a lot of speculation that the sun doesn't always cycle through sunspots, that sometimes the sun is spotless for a period of a century or so. And the presence of sunspots has been associated with weather. Why the sunspots would affect the weather is not at all clear. That is to say, the mechanism, but there's moderately robust relationships between them. So one thing that, of course, you might guess is that if the sun is covered with black spots, it's dimmer, and maybe a dimmer sun is going to lead to cooler weather and maybe not as good agricultural production and something like that. Turns out we know that's not the case. It turns out the sun is actually brighter when it has spots than when it doesn't. That is to say, the darkness of the spots is more than made up with the brightness of the phages on the surface of the sun. And it's a very small effect. It's like a few parts per thousand. So it's hard to see how anything like that would affect much. But maybe. There are lots of people who believe that sunspots, and in particular the absence of sunspots for years, maybe makes an effect on the Earth's weather. So incidentally, we can look at other stars. There are lots of stars that are more or less like the sun, and some of them seem to be cycling with sunspots and some of them don't. So it does kind of make sense that maybe the sun doesn't do what it's been doing for the last several hundred years, namely cycling through bunches of sunspots. And when it doesn't do that, maybe it's in a slightly different mode, which might affect conditions on Earth. Not hugely. So the medieval cool spell in Europe is often associated with an absence of sunspots. But as I say, the data is really spotty. Just Chinese observers in the pre-Galilean period. So most of our time was spent on why the sun doesn't explode. And I usually have a hard time convincing people that this is an interesting question. So I started out trying to convince you that explosions are actually usual, that the mechanism of reaction automatically leads to explosion. It has what's called positive feedback. So whether we're talking about chemical reactions, whether we're talking about nuclear reactions, it all starts with a collision between two particles. And if that collision is energetic enough, then we're going to get a reaction, and the reaction is going to rearrange the constituents, and in the process, either chemical energy or nuclear energy is going to be released. If you dump energy on a system, in my life, I've only experienced that increases the temperature. We know that temperature increases the speed of the constituent particles. We're going to have more collisions per second, and they're going to be more energetic collisions, and all of that is going to lead to more reactions. More reactions are going to release more energy. It's going to increase the temperature more. It's going to lead to even faster speeds. And there's no end to this process, right? So the idea is in a very short period of time, we have 100% of the material burned to a crisp. So in my life, I've only seen fairly controlled explosions. If explosions are so usual, why don't I see them every day? And the answer is that for most chemical reactions, it takes two different ingredients. So it takes natural gas and oxygen, or it takes wood and oxygen. Typically takes two things, one of them often oxygen, in order to react. And we usually just keep them separate, right? If we kept them in the same container, they still might not explode if the minimum conditions, the minimum temperature that's required to get any reactions to go, wasn't achieved. So sugar, wood, those things will burn if you get them hot enough, but sitting on your tabletop, sitting in a pile outside, they don't burn. So when we get burning of those sorts of material, it's typically only on an interface between the fuel and the oxygen. So when we get things like natural gas explosions as opposed to natural gas flames on our ovens, what's happening is we're getting a homogeneous mixture of natural gas, say in the kitchen, and then we can have this positive feedback situation which leads to the explosive burning of that stuff. Okay, so after that, I hope I've convinced you that the sun looks like it's in trouble, because it doesn't require two ingredients, right? It just requires hydrogen, so nothing is being kept separate. And clearly the temperature that's required for the reaction is achieved because we know it's going on. So why doesn't more lead to more? Why doesn't it explode all the time? And some stars do explode, so it's not that it's impossible for something like the sun to explode. And the answer is a mathematical theorem called the Virial theorem. And like any theorem, it's got hypotheses and conclusions. So if something is made out of a normal gas, and to say normal is to say that there's a possibility for an abnormal gas, and the difference between normal and abnormal doesn't have to do with composition. That is to say, any gas could be normal or abnormal. It just depends on the density and temperature. So abnormal gases, which are called degenerate gases, are favored by having extremely high density. Well, boy, the sun's got extremely high density, but also low temperature. And obviously stars don't have low temperature. So stars that are going to not satisfy the Virial theorem and hence explode, they're generally speaking, they're getting dense and they're getting hotter, but they're getting denser faster than they're getting hotter. So they end up becoming degenerate, and then they're going to go boom. And held together by gravity, right? So a bottle of oxygen that's floating in space isn't held together by gravity. It's held together by the container. So it's not in danger of exploding. But stars mostly are made out of normal gas and held together by gravity, so they are subject to the Virial theorem. And the conclusions are kind of surprising. If you shine your phaser on a star, the result is the temperature goes down, not up. If you drop an iceberg into a star, the result is the star gets hotter, not cooler. And it works in this really funny fashion, that if you add, say, one unit of energy, it turns out that the temperature goes down, which means that there's less kinetic energy, but the star expands, and if you move something up in a gravitational field, we have more potential energy. And the gain in potential energy is more than the loss of kinetic energy, and it's 2-to-1 like that diagram shows, so that the result is that we have less kinetic energy but more total energy in that sort of situation. Now, it seems pretty incredible that it works that way, and it's not actually a particularly hard theorem to prove, but I'm not going to prove it today. But I did want to try and give you a feeling as to how it works. And it really works just like this. That is to say, the molecules that are in the sun really are orbiting the sun. They're not crushed to the center. And if we add energy to a rocket that's orbiting the Earth, if we fire the rocket like that, the result is we go to a higher orbit and we're moving slower. So we add energy, we reduce our kinetic energy, but we increase our potential energy more than twice as much as the loss of kinetic energy. And if we fire our retro rocket, if we reduce the energy of our orbit, the result is we go to a closer orbit where we have less potential energy, but even more kinetic energy, since things that are orbiting closer to the Earth are going faster. So it really works just like the orbiting spacecraft, and of course this Virial theorem is going to break this step. If the sun were to overproduce energy, it would go down in temperature, which would be exactly what would be necessary to turn down the furnace. Well, so first of all, this isn't the surface of the sun we don't have to worry about, right? Because it's not at anything like the ignition temperature. The surface of the sun's only at thousands of degrees hot, so it's really the core we're talking about. But if we add energy to the core at the same physical distance, the temperature is going to be less, in addition to the thing expanding out.
Okay.
at the same physical distance from the core. And that would include the literally center of the core, right? So the center of the core doesn't move if the thing expands. But that would be reduced in temperature if you added energy to it. And incidentally, what goes on to the core isn't necessarily reflected on the surface. So not uncommonly, these stars that are have their core expanding or contracting, their outside surface can be doing most anything. There's a real disconnect between the very dense parts of stars at the core and the outer layers, which are very rarefied gases. So remember, the whole outer convection area of the so-called sun is less dense than the air in this room. And so it can expand hugely, or it can contract hugely with relatively small inputs. It's this really dense, you know, 10 times the density of lead, 15 million degrees hot core where really the action is for the sun. So we talk some about the problems that we have with the sun. So the oldest problem with the sun is just understanding how it could possibly be powered. So early on, people calculated, you know, if the sun were made out of 100% coal, how long could it burn? And the answer is not very long. The best guess, pre an understanding of nuclear physics, was that maybe the sun was powered by gravity. That is to say, as the sun contracted, it would be giving up gravitational potential energy, which could be radiated away. This is so-called Calvin-Helmholtz calculation. And none of these things are sufficient for really even 100 million years, let alone a billion years, and we need to explain 4.5 billion years. So for probably 20 years or so, it may not sound like a long time, around the turn of the century, there was a real disconnect between the biologists who demanded millions or billions of years in order for evolution to occur, and the physicists who said, the sun can only last 100 million years. But once we figured out that the sun was powered by fusion, there's plenty of fuel there to last 10 billion years, so it became not a problem. So generally speaking, nuclear energy releases on the order of a million times more than chemical energy. So suddenly we have enough power to last a long time. So starting in the 60s, people said, well, if it's powered by these fusion reactions, every fusion reaction produces neutrinos, we should be able to measure those neutrinos and get a handle on what's going on in the center of the sun, right? So we've talked about sound waves being one thing that can move from the center of the sun out, and so we can learn about the interior of the sun by studying sound waves. Well, neutrinos are another. So the plan was to understand the interior of the sun by measuring something that was right from the sun, the neutrinos. And so starting in the 60s and for the next 40 years, people tried lots of different ways, lots of different people, and they always came up short. So only about a third of the required neutrinos were found, and people were puzzled for a long period of time. But in the last 10 years, people have figured out that what's happening has nothing to do with the production of the neutrinos. It has nothing to do with the detection of the neutrinos. Those things are all happening exactly as people thought in the 60s. What's happening is in the in-between area, the neutrinos are oscillating from something that the detector was aimed to detect to something it's not designed to detect. So what we're seeing is a change in the neutrinos as they go from the center of the sun to the Earth. And the only reason I say it's not 100% solved is that all of the details of the neutrino oscillation, all of the possible ways that neutrinos can oscillate, they haven't been all pinned down yet. It's hard to do. Neutrinos are hard to detect, but it's clear that neutrinos oscillate, and that's enough to explain the deficit. The hot corona. So you can't heat something hotter than the temperature of the thing that's heating it, but the corona is way hotter than the surface of the sun. How can it be? And that's, you know, so I got 10% solved. And really the only part of it that's solved is the part that we knew right from the start, that whatever is heating the corona has to be 2 million degrees hot. And the idea is that the boundary between the convection zone and the radiation zone has about the right temperature, And presumably some sort of waves are being generated in the this magnetized plasma, and they are propagating, as sound can, from the interior of the sun to the outside. They're dumping their energy, those waves are breaking in the corona, and depositing energy. But exactly what waves and exactly how it works, those things are up for grabs. But it for sure involves magnetic fields and plasma, and the connection to the heat source being the convection zone / radiation zone. Solar cycle, well, we observed it, there's no doubt about that, but why? Why 11 years? I mean, so can we calculate how the sun makes a magnetic field and why it reverses every 11 years? So first thing to notice is that the magnetic field of the sun is different from the planets we've been talking about, right? Because usually the convecting, conducting fluid was in the inside, but here the conducting, convecting fluid is basically in the outside. It's in the convection zone. So it's a little bit different from planetary magnetic fields. And no one has a calculation that has the sun cycling at the 11 years. And of course, there's some suggestions that it doesn't always cycle at 11 years. So there's a lot to learn about the sunspot cycle. I tacked on two other things that I thought about. So one thing, the bottom one is maybe the one that's most immediately relevant. You all know that you can't predict the weather on Earth, you know, more than a few days in advance. And the basic reason has to do with convection. The fundamental way that weather works has to do with convection. And convection is a complicated fluid dynamic problem that has the property of sensitive dependence on the initial conditions. So that if you misguess what the temperature is 2 meters over there, or in the usual formulation of it, if you think about a butterfly beating its wings in China, with this sensitive dependence of initial conditions, that could cause a hurricane, 3 years later in the mid-Atlantic. So convection is always a problem to deal with in detail. And we always deal with it when we're talking about the Earth's weather, when we're talking about the sun, not in terms of the detailed mechanism, but in some sort of parameterization of it. So for example, for cloud formation, there isn't in weather models, there isn't something that guarantees that a cloud is going to form at this time, at this location. Rather, there's a statistical correlation that if the humidity is this and the temperature is that, then on average, the cloudiness is going to be this. So those sorts of parameterizations, it's not clear how they would apply generally, and in particular apply to other stars. So people adjust those parameters until they work, but that's not a very pleasing way of saying that you understand how the sun works in detail. So we have really good models of how the sun works that are verified through helioseismometry, but there's a little bit of fine-tuning that's going on in those parameterizations. I think if we were to apply those models to new stars, we'd be less confident that they would work as well as they do for the sun. Just as when we apply models that work pretty well on Earth to Mars or Venus or Jupiter, they don't work as well as they work for Earth. So the other question is kind of a puzzle that you might contemplate on, and it's really a puzzle that's a topic for the other class. And that is, why is there any hydrogen left over at all? So you know that the whole television show started with a big bang, and situations were as hot and as dense as you would want. And generally speaking, the results of an explosion are ash, they're not fuel. But somehow or other, the big bang left behind all of this good stuff to burn. Even though it was hot enough to burn it, and it was dense enough to burn it, why is there so much leftover hydrogen in the universe? So about 10%, well, it depends on how you measure, 25% by mass, 10% by number, a certain fraction of the hydrogen was burned into helium in the early universe, but the vast majority of it still remains. And how did that come about? Why is there so much leftover fuel from the biggest explosion in history. So the last topic I want to take up with about the sun is just kind of a review of how we know these things. What measurements have been made about the sun that allow us to come up with this data? So how do we get the distance to the sun? It turns out that historically that was a hard thing to come up with. If all you could do is survey with telescopes, it's hard to get the distance to the sun. But these days we can bounce radar, getting smaller and smaller pieces of chalk. We can bounce radar off the planets and the sun. We can get the distance to these objects accurate to basically within centimeters in the case of the moon. About the size, the radius of the sun. Well, if we know how big it seems to be in the sky, if we know the angle, boy, if we know the angle and we know the distance, then high school geometry allows you to get the size. About the mass. Well, you remember that Kepler's third law is that if you have something that's going around another object and you know how long it takes it to go around and you know the distance it is from the center, you can calculate the mass. About the surface temperature. Well, you remember that the broad shape of the light, the black body spectra, tells you the temperature. How about the surface composition? What's the surface made from? Well, that has to do with the absorption lines in the sun. So we know that every chemical element has distinct colors that it absorbs. If we take a look at the spectra of the sun, then we can see what chemical elements are in there. In this case, it's absorption lines. Now, the story is a little bit trickier than maybe that short statement makes, because people were unsure about the composition of the sun as recently as about 1920. And the reason is that if you look at the absorption lines of the sun, if you were to read the labels of the chemical elements that are causing most of those absorption lines, you'd see that they're mostly metals. Iron, sodium, potassium, those all have very prominent absorption lines in the sun. So early on, people thought that the sun had a composition pretty similar to the Earth, that it had a lot of metals. And Cecilia Payne is really the first one who came up with an explanation that it was really made out of hydrogen and helium. And it's one of those great stories in the history of science. She wrote her PhD thesis, and probably the most famous American astronomer, what's his first name? Russell. Yeah, can't remember his first name right now. So Russell said, so she said in her PhD thesis, it looks like the sun is mostly made out of hydrogen. And Russell said, no, it doesn't. You're probably wrong. So it's one of the greatest mistakes in the history of astronomy, that the most famous American astronomer poo-pooed this idea in the PhD thesis of Celia Payne. And of course, it didn't take too long to figure out that she was right and Russell was wrong. And remember, the problem has to do with hydrogen and helium. Hydrogen and helium don't have prominent absorption lines in the optical version of the spectra. So turns out that the things that cause the biggest absorption lines happen to be metals, but hydrogen and helium have their absorption lines in other regions of the spectra. The other piece of the puzzle is an Indian physicist named Saha, who came up with an explanation of how all of this worked. So none of these people were white male, which may not have helped their arguments. How about the insides? Well, we really had a pretty good idea of the insides of stars for many decades. I'm not sure when I would say we had a great idea based on modeling. So we know how, once you know what the composition is, you know how much hydrogen weighs, you know what the surface temperature is, you can work through the physics of what's going on, and you can calculate what the inside is pretty well. But these days we have helioseismometry, which directly tells us the temperature and density to within about 1% accuracy throughout the inside of the sun. What's up? So the magnetic field of the sun, you remember we get that, we don't land anything on the surface of the sun. The atomic absorption lines depend on the exact location, the exact energy jump depends on the magnetic field. And by precisely measuring the location of these lines, we can figure out what the magnetic field is. It's called the Zeeman effect. So the energy levels that you have in an atom, of course, the jumps define the wavelengths. And it turns out that the exact way that an electron can orbit depends a little bit, a very small amount, on the magnetic field. So and we can do this experiment in our lab. We can subject iron to strong magnetic fields and see how the energy levels move around by hundreds of angstroms and figure out what the magnetic field is on the surface of the sun. Rotation. Well, Galileo started this right by just timing sunspots, and that led to the discovery of differential rotation, where the equator is rotating faster than the poles, and so all of those are good for the surface rotation. Remember that it's seismic waves that give us the interior rotation. It might be, you know, since we're thinking about the finite, it might be useful to think about Galileo and the sunspots and those sort of controversies that we were talking about in the first lectures. So remember that one of the concerns the Aristotelians had was that, you know, if the Earth was actually moving and a bird was flying around, it wouldn't be able to keep up with the Earth. But what Galileo could argue is, look, there are these sunspots, and you think that the sun is moving, and those sunspots don't have any trouble keeping up with the sun. So, you know, kind of what works for one has to work for the other. And these days, of course, we call this Galilean invariance, which says that if you're moving fast in an airplane, it's exactly the same as if you're not moving fast. Things drop, things fly, exactly the same at any old speed you'd want to mention. Age. So we usually use some sort of radioactive dating of rocks, and we can't directly get a piece of the sun. Well, the sun spits out pieces of itself all the time in the solar wind, but it's just hydrogen and helium, which turn out not to be very good for radioactive dating. So usually we judge the age of the whole solar system by looking at meteorites. They have the oldest material that is left over from the formation of the solar system about 4.5 billion years ago. Power source. Well, originally this was just process of elimination, right? Nothing except nuclear energy could work, and for 30 years, from about 1920 to 1950, people couldn't really figure out what nuclear reactions could work. But it had to be nuclear reactions, because you needed something that was a million times more energetic than chemical reactions, and nuclear reactions did it. These days we have the neutrinos, so we know that nuclear stuff is going on. And we can directly measure the temperature and density at the inside of the sun and calculate the rates that the reaction should be occurring at, and it all matches. So questions about the sun, solar system?
Just to clear this up, So the sun is just, is it more of a fission reaction or a fusion reaction, or would you say a combination of both?
So I certainly wouldn't say a combination of both, and I wouldn't say fission. So fission requires a big nucleus, like uranium. Mm-hmm. And you remember what the sun is made out of is little nuclei, like hydrogen and helium. So it's 100% fusion.
Okay.
So the generally speaking, the sun is well mixed. So the metals that are in the surface of the sun are also throughout the sun. So just as the oxygen concentration of the Earth's atmosphere is the same if you go up 10 kilometers or if you are at the surface of the Earth, same thing with the metal composition. So kind of the thing that's, I don't know if I want to use the word unusual, because it's exactly the same problem that we had with the giant planets. What's a little bit unusual is that the rare constituents have very obvious absorption lines, so they're easy to pick out. So if you naively just look at what produces lots of absorption lines, you're going to come to the wrong conclusion. And this applies as much to the giant planets as it does to the sun. The prominent absorption lines in Jupiter's atmosphere are from things like ammonia and methane and water. But we know that the atmosphere is hydrogen and helium, 99%. It's just that those guys don't produce prominent absorption lines. So it's a matter of figuring out, basically, given the very small intensity that you have for the hydrogen and helium lines, how much you have to boost that to recognize how much hydrogen there is actually in that source. I'm not sure that's a great explanation. So I'm not sure I want to say more, though. Helium in particular is very easy. It doesn't produce any absorption lines in the normal optical spectra. It's absorption. It's a very chemically compact object. There are big jumps that are required in order to excite the electrons. There are no chemical compounds that you could see rotating that are a result of it. So helium is a clear-cut, difficult case to measure. Hydrogen has a handful of ways that under kind of unusual conditions it'll produce some absorption lines. And you have to kind of adjust for how unusual it is. You know, so maybe only 1 in a million hydrogen molecules is in the right possibility to emit any absorption or emission line. So what you measure, you then have to multiply by a million in order to figure out what the actual concentration is. So it's a big puzzle. And it's kind of funny if you just read, you know, century-old astronomy books, how they're talking about, you know, stars that are made out of iron and sodium and things like that. And No, they're not made out of iron and sodium and stuff like that. They're, you know, just way off base, less than 100 years ago. More questions? So, you know, the next topic is life, and it's a big topic. And I never know exactly how to start talking about it. So first of all, let me convince you that it's huge. And so if you are a geologist, undergraduate geologist, you go to graduate school in geology. If you're a physicist, you go to graduate school in physics. If you're a chemist, you go to graduate school in chemistry. But if you go to graduate school, you don't go to graduate school in biology. You go in biochemistry or microbiology or physiology. So what we call biology at the graduate level is more than a dozen different disciplines. It's huge. In contrast to the other topics that we've been talking about, like meteorology, physics, astronomy, those things are all relatively compact, but there's a huge story that's involved with life. So in astronomy, Our main focus is going to be, is there life in the universe? And obviously I'm going to have something to say about this topic, but I think we might as well just vote on it. That is to say that it really isn't there really isn't any good data. So this is a matter of kind of talking about nothing. I think I have some things to say about it that are useful, but I actually think that your opinions are pretty much as valuable too, given that we have no good information. So let's decide in this class whether there's life in the universe. So who believes in, you know, kind of contacts in the third kind, right? So this is where people in the last century have touched an alien or had an alien drill them with some sort of device. One. So how about any time during history? So there are people who believe that aliens helped build the pyramids and things like that. So not recently, but aliens were around sometime in the last million years to presumably help, but you know, maybe eat people. If you believe in third kind, you pretty much have to believe in history. Just, I don't gain any people for building pyramids. How about any place in the solar system? So we're talking about microbes on Mars or microbes under Europa. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. How about any place in the galaxy? Everyone. Well, so obviously, if everyone thinks it's in the galaxy, everyone believes that it's in the universe, how about intelligent life? Not microscopic life, but somebody conceivably that we could talk to. 3, 4. Yeah, just in the galaxy. I don't know, 5 or something like that. So how many think that the probability is more than 50% that in your lifetime there'll be a credible news story, that somebody will get a Nobel Prize for? How about that? That somebody will get a Nobel Prize for discovering, first of all, life, any life. So this is a Nobel for life anywhere in the universe in your lifetime. So we're talking about the future, so we can only talk about probabilities. So more than 50% chance. Well, so how about intelligent life? We talk to aliens. In your lifetime. 2. I pretty much agree with people. I'm not, so if I were going to disagree with something, I think this is probably what I would disagree with the most. And there just isn't any evidence, right? Your opinion is just as good as mine, as far as I can tell. It's not that those were right answers or wrong answers. I can make a good case for there being life in the solar system, and what I can say is we haven't found any yet. So it's a matter of whether we've searched adequately yet. And I guess one of the things I usually emphasize is you pretty much have to go with that answer. I would say it's a wrong answer. Well, would I say that? I might say that it's a wrong answer to say that there's no life in the universe based on the following argument. As far as we can tell, and I think we have good reason to suspect this, the universe is actually infinite. And if you have an actually infinite universe, then all possibilities have to be actualized. Right? So even if the chance is 1 over a billion to a billion to a billion, if it's actually infinite, somebody's going to win the lottery, right? Now the galaxy is a much smaller place, so it's and is also in some sense the only relevant place. That is to say, the galaxy is roughly speaking 100,000 light years in size. So if we're ever going to have any useful data, it's going to have to come from the from just our galaxy, I would say. There are speculations that intelligent life might populate a whole galaxy and then produce enough light, radio waves, to be observed from a whole galaxy, but that's real speculative. So, what can we say, perhaps more usefully than voting about life? Well, we have one example of life, right? We got life on this planet. So what does that data tell us about how life works? And of course, one example is a terrible extrapolation to make out of. So what's kind of the nature of life? Well, we got to start with chemistry. So what are typical biological molecules? This is a word that can really, I think, cause confusion, because in some sense there are no biological molecules. As far as we can tell, so-called biological molecules are no different than non-biological molecules. It's all just chemistry, and there's no fundamental difference. So in terms of classes of biological molecules, we've got fatty acids. So these are kind of what fatty acids look like. Generally speaking, long chains of hydrogen and carbon, maybe some double bonds put in there, and these are fatty acids, so they have this carboxylic acid group hooked onto them. Okay, so we've got fats. Big chains of carbon and oxygen. Gasoline kind of equivalents. We've got carbohydrates. So these are kind of typical carbohydrates. Sugars. So they are combinations of carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen. So maybe I should explain how these pictures work. In this picture here, I bothered to show all of the C's. And that gets boring because carbon is basically the backbone of life, and often we can get away without bothering to show these C's. So every one of these intersections, there's actually a little carbon there that's providing the backbone. So if we count them up, glucose is a six carbon compound with lots of C's and O's and H's around. Fructose is a very similar sort of compound. If we put these two guys together, and the way they come together is by kind of pulling out water that's in here, we get table sugar. So table sugar is a combination of two monosaccharides to make a disaccharide. These are monosaccharides, one sugar, take out a water, we get a disaccharide. And we can do this again and again and again. We can make big molecules that have monosaccharides hooked together, and those are starches. Then we got proteins. Proteins are made from amino acids. So acid is this key word that means carboxylic acid. Double bond to hydrogen and then an OH group hooked on. It's an acid because this hydrogen here can come off it. Acids are things that can emit ionized hydrogen protons. It also has a basic group, acid and bases being kind of opposite things, that's part of this thing that's a little bit like ammonia. So ammonia is NH3. This is an amino group which has NH2, and then it's hooked on to this carbon backbone. So this particular carbon that has both a carboxylic acid group associated with and a basic amino group with it, it's the highlight of being being an amino acid. And we can hook on lots of different things where this R is. R is just meaning lots of different things can be hooked in. And we can put together amino acids to make proteins and peptides by kind of something similar. We're going to take out this water, and we can hook together then two amino acids. Right, so we can put together amino acids to form proteins. Nucleic acids. So, 1953, I think, Watson and Crick, Crick being the physicist, Watson being the molecular biologist, with a lot of work from Rosalind Franklin, who died before she got the Nobel Prize, figured out this structure for DNA. So DNA consists of kind of a spiral staircase. So we have this backbone that consists of sugars held together by phosphate groups. And the sugars can be either ribose, it's a 5-carbon sugar if you add them up, or it can be deoxyribose. So this is DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, and if this were we had ribose in the bonds, and we'd have RNA, ribonucleic acid. The steps in this spiral staircase are made out of pairs that are somewhat loosely bonded together by what are called hydrogen bonds. So this connection between a negatively charged oxygen and a positively charged hydrogen called the hydrogen bond. It's not as strong as these things that are shown as little dash lines. So it turns out that these things only like to come together in certain pairs. So you'll always see here that A and T are bonded together, and C and G are bonded together in these various steps. And this basically makes a digital code of a sequence of TAs and Gs. And it turns out that the TAs and Gs specify various possibilities for amino acids in kind of a very straightforward way. So we can that we put them together in triplets. So if we have uracil, 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 then we'll get a particular amino acid. And so here's the code. We can specify any amino acids we want based on one of these triplets. So this is the blueprints for making proteins. We have a sequence of specifications. We want this protein, we want this amino acid, followed by this amino acid, followed by this amino acid, in order to make a particular protein. Now, kind of uncomfortably, in order to have this process work, it turns out we need to have a lot of helper proteins. That is to say, DNA won't spontaneously produce anything. It needs to have a lot of partners in order, basically little machines, in order to make this process work. So we have this kind of chicken and egg sort of situation where the nucleic acids are drawing the proteins, but the proteins are necessary in order to make the nucleic acids work. So it's pretty much literally a chicken and an egg sort of situation where, in terms of history, which one came first? Not particularly clear. So 1860 is kind of a key decade for biology. We got a lot of important folks coming in here. So this is Darwin, his book Origin of the Species. And Origin of Species, of course, is a way that natural selection could create different species. So Darwin very much based his book on what he called artificial selection. So you know that there are all sorts of different dog breeds that are all dogs, but all look pretty different. So for example, there was one cat that showed up in Scotland that had a droopy ear. And by breeding that cat, we now have a whole breed of specialized droopy ears cats, which some people like. Darwin talks about a particular type of pigeon called the tumbler. And these birds have what you would guess is not a very happy trait, that while they're trying to fly in a straight line, they suddenly start to tumble. And they recover in time not to hit the ground, or else they wouldn't survive. But by breeding these guys, we can make whole flocks of tumblers. So the basic idea of natural selection, evolution, is pretty much undeniable, right? And that is that the children are products of the parents, and the chance that the child is going to produce progeny is determined by the characteristics that it has. So it's evolution is essentially just the chain of parent to child to grandchild, and the statement that whatever lives, lives. And presumably your chance of living depends on your characteristics, and the characteristics that you have depend on the characteristics that your parents have. And by this process of natural as opposed to artificial selection, nature will choose things that that do well, that have lots of children. Okay, so Darwin. Mendel. So Mendel is famous slash not famous for genetics. So it's perfectly clear that when a man and a woman have a child, they don't have a she-man as a child, right? They get either women or men as children, typically. So that the characteristics of the child aren't kind of the average of the characteristics of the parents. There's some kind of random recombination of the characteristics of the parents. And the idea of how that all works out goes under the name genetics, right? So the idea is that the parents have some combination, a million different characteristics, and mother has a million characteristics, the father has a million characteristics, the child gets some random assortment of those characteristics, some of them which might be good and lead to a higher probability of producing children, and some of them might be not good. And this kind of random assortment of those primary characteristics in the parent are given over to the children. So this idea that the parents determine the output, determine the characteristics of the child, but not in an averaging way, that's implicit in Darwin. But Darwin had no idea about Mendel. They were working in isolation. Mendel in particular was working in isolation. So he was a cleric and he became abbot. And once he became abbot, he ended his kind of scientific work. And it turns out that his papers were all burned at one point. So he had to be rediscovered circa 1900 before people figured out, I wouldn't say the mechanism of all of this, but kind of the mathematics of all of this, the proof that you get this independent assortment of characteristics that are in the parents. Pasteur. So, I assume all of these names are familiar to you. They should be familiar to you. Pasteur from pasteurization, if nothing else. So, time immemorial, people had thought about spontaneous generation. It's the obvious thing, right? You put out a piece of meat, and it goes bad. So flies don't necessarily have parents. They can just kind of spontaneously occur inside of a piece of meat. And it's the way it works, right? You put any piece of organic material out and pretty soon it's going to spoil, which is to say that it's going to have lots of life present on it. And Pasteur is off, so this was something in the air, so it's not clear that Pasteur deserves 100% of the credit for this particular possibility. But Pasteur is famous for doing kind of the following experiment. So he took some nice chicken broth and heated it up to high temperatures so that there wasn't anything, so he thought there wasn't anything living in it in the time. And he sealed off this container and he found out that the chicken broth didn't get cloudy, didn't spoil, that is to say, didn't have abundant life for periods of months. Right? So this is how canning can work today, right? You can put stuff that would spoil, sterilize it, put it in a can, and it'll stay edible for long periods of time. So people had done this experiment before and had come to the opposite conclusions, and the problems were that they had not totally eliminated this connection, so that there was some exchange of what they thought was pure air between the liquid that was in the container and the outside. But apparently some invisible stuff was coming into the air and somehow spoiling the material that was in there. And Pasteur is very closely connected with all of that. The realization that microbiology is almost all of biology. So most of the cells in your body are not human cells. They are bacterial cells. They're more of the little buggers than there are of the big buggers by far. So, of course, the idea of microbiology made is very helpful by the existence of microscopes. And microscopes were started out, in fact, Galileo made microscopes in addition to making telescopes. So people like Leeuwenhoek and Hooke. Hooke was a contemporary of Newton. They looked at things with pretty crude microscopes and sometimes saw things, sometimes didn't see things. And people realized that there was a micro world, but it took a while to realize that these microbes were responsible for basically every important process on Earth, right? Including health, right? Germs associated with microorganisms today. Not so prior to 1860. Okay, so, kind of three big names of biology, all publishing pretty much simultaneously in the 1860s to get good roots to that discipline. So if we're going to kind of jump over a big bit of history, we can go to 1953 where we have Watson and Crick. So Watson is, you can't call him. There's a long history of people like Watson who these days are called molecular biologists. As opposed to biochemists, oddly enough. Different sorts of people with similar sounding names. Figured out that this stuff that is DNA has this structure which easily can explain how you can have recording of the specifications for making proteins in this kind of digital fashion. But of course, recognizing that it has this spiral structure that can encode things essentially digitally It's a long way from there to understanding how exactly this process works, how exactly the DNA is transcribed into proteins, which are basically the thing that counts, the machines that are your body. And the way this works is a little bit odd, and it's not clear what this is telling us. You would think that there would be some sort of kind of rational process, but instead of the DNA kind of directly producing the proteins, it does it in kind of an odd fashion. The DNA is transferred into segments of RNA, and then the RNA is read like magnetic tape in a machine that's called a ribosome. And that's where these triplets are put together in order to produce a sequence of amino acids, which is, of course, the protein. So there's this kind of flow of information, DNA to RNA to protein, that is kind of the central dogma of how this biology works. There are a handful of exceptions with things not working in this order, but basically this is how biology works for all sets of organisms. So how did it all start? Right? So what Pasteur says is there is no such thing as spontaneous generation. The only way we get life is from life. And so if you work that backwards, how does that work out? Well, Darwin actually in a letter suggests that maybe if instead of having this flask sit around for months, if you let that flask sit around for 100 million years, maybe you would get spontaneous generation. Maybe it is possible to produce these living machines that we call life from random chemical elements if you just wait long enough and have the right sort of chemical elements. And obviously we can't wait millions of years in our laboratories. People only wait 5-6 years to get a PhD. So the nearest thing to this that people tried to do is they tried to kind of recreate the situation that you would have earlier in the Earth. So we would put water and ammonia and methane, the sort of small, I'll call them inorganic molecules, and we would subject them to the sorts of things that would occur. So of course we would have heating from, for example, geological formations and or impacting meteors. We might have electrical storms, so we're going to have some sparking. And we just run this system for as long as the graduate students are willing to do it. And, as long as the graduate students are willing to do it is a few years, and we don't get life out of this, but what we do get is very complicated molecules. So we can start out with things that are small, and we can build up to much bigger pieces. And through experiments pretty much like this, essentially all of the amino acids have been formed by kind of random recombination of the basic elements. So that's Darwin talked about a quiet little pond sitting around for 100 million years. Maybe that's the sort of situation that could spontaneously generate life. But exactly how that process could occur is far from clear. Okay, so we'll take up more biology next time. So chapter 28 in the book.